You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
Jeff and Eric noticed one day that nobody on the internet talked about movies, so they had to find a way. They'll podcast thoughts on new movies they've discovered through autumn, winter, spring, and summer on Fridays. And when you run out of films you love to view, tune into jokes, playing games, all this and more, you'll find contained on PBS with Bear and Snyder.
Hello and welcome to Movie BS with Bear and Snyder. I am Jeff Bear. I am the host. This is my co-host, Eric D. Snyder.
Hey, hello, Eric D. Snyder here with my old pal, Jeff Bear. My old pal and co-host, Jeff Bear. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
It's a big show. It's a big, exciting show. Because you know why? Well, you know why. But do you know why?
Wait. Was I the second?
You were the first one.
I was the first. Okay,
but do you, listeners, know why?
Do we pause and wait? Wait.
Give your answer now.
Okay.
Here's the reason why. Because we have an interview.
With
the writer-director of Green Room, Jeremy Saulnier. And the star of that film, Anton Yelchin. Before we get to that, though, we should go ahead and review Green Room.
We should.
We should get that out of the way, because it would be really awkward if we hated Green Room and then interviewed him.
Yeah, let's find out if we liked it or not.
Let's find out if we did, yeah.
Starting now.
Green Room is amazing.
It's so good.
Green Room is really, really good. It's an intense movie. Let me tell you up front, we're going to say a lot of nice things about this movie. And I think we're going to end by saying that it's BS approved and you should see it. I don't want to. We haven't discussed it in great detail, but I think.
I don't know.
I know you pretty well, and I feel like that's the vibe I'm getting from you. But we should say this movie is not for everyone.
No.
It has some very intense moments of violence and fear and whatnot.
And it's an authentic ugly violence.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, oh, I've seen Arnold Schwarzenegger kill 500 people. It's cool. I can handle it.
Yeah. No, it's not gratuitous, and there's not like a huge body count, really. But it's the nature of the violence and the situation. Oh, it's so tense, and I get that sweat yeah. just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Here's what we have. We have a punk band, a punk hardcore. Yeah, one of those bands, one of those loud metal-y kind of bands.
Yeah.
They're called the Ain't Rights, which is a fine name for a band. And they're touring around, and like in their van, they got to steal gas. Like they don't have any money. They're total, like, do-it-yourself, low-budget band. And they somehow wind up doing a show for some neo-Nazis.
Yeah, so neo-Nazis.
They didn't mean to.
Well, here's the thing. It's a known thing. Like the depth that this film constructs for you, you don't need to be a fan of punk music. You don't need to have a deep understanding of neo-Nazis, but it'll all be trickled in so you can understand this. And neo-Nazis happen to be fans of punk music. So
I don't think it's really, is it really punk music? I feel like we're getting that wrong and showing that we're idiots.
No. This is hardcore like punk.
Hardcore punk. All right. It's not like the Ramones, because it's harder than that.
Right. It's harder than that. Well, and not only that, this particular band is like, man, I don't want to burn a CD because that'll taint the music. that's how they are.
They've got some really naive ideas about purity, as do the Nazis, for that matter.
Purity, but they're not not beyond like siphoning gas to keep on moving and stuff like that.
They're keeping it real.
That's right.
Yeah, so it is not. They don't like the Nazis, but yeah, with their genre of music, that sometimes is a thing that you do. You wind up having Nazis in your audience. And
right.
So they're out at some place, out in rural Oregon is the most specifically we're told, this like a roadhouse bar dance place, bands play kind of a thing. And I don't know what you call a place like that.
Yeah, it's actually the place that these neo-Nazis really make home for the most part. Mm-hmm. Like it's headquarters almost.
Headquarters for the skinheads.
To have a nice stage for bands to come and play because, you know, neo-Nazis. They like to have fun on occasion.
Say what you will about the Nazis.
And they're jumping and their music and
say what you will about Nazis. They have fantastic rhythm. Great dancers, the Nazis. So our band, Anton Yelchin and some other people. Aaliyah Shawkat.
Yeah,
she's in there.
I was going to say.
They go and they perform there. And the green room, as you know, of course, the green room is the room where the performers hang out before the show. And just after the show, in the green room, as they're fixing to leave, because they want to get out of here. They don't like the Nazis. They don't want to stick around any longer than necessary.
Yeah, it makes them a little uncomfortable. They need the cash.
Right.
They did their thing. They, you know, ruffled some feathers, and now they're ready to go.
Let's get out of town. And then something happens in the green room, and now there's trouble. There's now trouble with our band and with the Nazis that run the place. The band has seen something the Nazis would rather they hadn't seen. And hoo boy, hang on to your seats, kids.
Humana, humana, humana. Yeah, and the really cool thing is you will know when the movie starts to get intense. Like, it's very obvious.
Right.
And then what transpires from that is two different groups, the neo-Nazis and the band, trying to figure out the best way to fix this situation for themselves. And the way that the movie goes about it, it's a lovely blend of, oh my gosh, this is really intense. We need to focus and think of something really quickly that will help us in this situation, to the point where it feels like the movie is one step ahead of me. Mm-hmm. Normally when you're watching these movies, it kind of feels like, oh, okay, you don't want to go upstairs. That's stupid. You're just leading into this plot so then this can happen and that
right.
can happen, or so on and so forth. And it feels like both sides are constantly doing the smartest thing they can for this situation.
Yeah,
it just keeps
It's rare to see a thriller that's like that, where you're not outsmarting the characters. And yeah, both sides.
And it doesn't also prey on dumb luck.
Right. Right.
And that's really nice too. And
both sides are trying to get out of the situation, and there's reason for optimism, at least at the outset, that this all still could end peacefully. Like there is a way out that we can resolve this, and nobody has to get hurt. It's not a spoiler, but people do get hurt.
Yes, that's a good point.
It does not end with nobody getting hurt.
And by the way, Patrick Stewart's in this film too.
Mm-hmm. He's the lead Nazi.
Yeah, that's right.
Chief
Patrick
of the
Stewart. Named Darcy, the lead Nazi named Darcy.
Yeah, he's the one that owns, he's the owner of this club here.
Right.
And he's very smart, always enforces the fire codes and everything. He's a good business owner, doesn't want any trouble with the cops or anything.
And for the most part, he picks his team well, he picks his strategy well. And it is just, you don't know what's going to happen next. When it's revealed what happens next, it makes you nervous for then what's going to happen after mm-hmm. that.
You mentioned there's a point where you realize, oh, this is intense, this is serious, and that happens. And then there's another thing a little bit after that where you're like, oh, I had no idea. Okay, that's what we're dealing with here.
Right, and it is. It's a really good intense, and in a weird way, you want to say realistic. I don't hang out with a lot of neo-Nazis,
but
everything about it seems accurate, like they've done their research mm-hmm. on the groups mm-hmm. Sort of thing. And it also feels like, yeah, this probably could happen to a punk band given this situation.
Right. I like – there are a lot of little touches I like. For example, in the siege in the green room and everything, as all that plays out, there's a point where the band uses feedback as a weapon, uses feedback mm-hmm. from the speakers. So I like that. Here's a punk band using their music as a weapon.
There's a twist on a motivational speech to get the guy's motivated for what lies ahead. Mm-hmm. And there's a lovely twist on that where it's like, all right, I've kind of seen this play out, but like, you know, the director knows that you've kind of seen this. So he adds a little zag to that zig in a nice way. And there's even, I don't know if you know this, Eric, when we get to social gatherings and there's nothing left to talk about, mm-hmm. I like to bring up random questions.
You do. Sometimes even when there's still plenty of other things to talk about.
Yeah, sometimes.
Sometimes you don't bother to wait for everything else to be exhausted.
Sometimes I don't even wait for the person to be done talking. I'm simply bored, and I'd mm-hmm. like to interject something random to motivate me to start listening to people again. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It happens. It happens from time to time. I can't mm-hmm. help it. Some people enjoy it about me. But there's a question in here like that fits perfectly into my wheelhouse, which is a desert island band. That's a lovely thing, too, in this little game that we're calling Green Room.
It's a throwaway thing, but it kind of establishes these characters being friends and palling around and chatting and stuff like people do.
And if you guys haven't seen, this is the third film from Jeremy, and Murder Party and Blue Ruin are both really good, and they also contain Macon Blair, who is back again as one of the neo-Nazis.
Right.
And it's also good to see that collaboration continuing. That's a fun one.
Blue Ruin we raved about on this show, and this is, and talk about how it was intense. Green Room is a more dramatic, like there's more things happening, I think, than Blue Ruin. Blue Ruin had a lot of
Blue Ruin had like a slow burn potential.
Yeah, slow burn. Yes, that's what it is.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to.
And not only that, the inner drama of Blue Ruin.
Right.
Whereas this is all on the outside.
It's all outer drama, and it is not a slow burn. It's a pretty swiftly moving burn. And I've seen it twice now, and both times I've been impressed that it doesn't get old, despite being mostly set in this one location. Like he finds ways to keep it interesting and keep it moving.
Yeah, and it is funny because I had a friend watch with us, and he knew nothing. He wanted to know nothing about the movie going in, and talking to him after, he was just like, yeah, so it just seemed like it was going to be a cool, like, coming-of-age band movie. Like, this is this punk band trying to make it in this music business.
Right.
And, yeah, even that's a compliment, because it's a good setup of not really seeing the danger line ahead, because there's no reason this band would.
Right, right. Good, tense, exciting, fun. I love the ending. I love the tone of the way that it ends. Mm-hmm. Just terrific all the way around. Let me say the one thing that I have a problem with. Patrick Stewart.
What?
I love Patrick Stewart in general. Here's the thing.
Oh, you talked about this the first time. It didn't change the second time.
No, it didn't. He just doesn't work for me as the head skinhead, and I think it's partly because of his voice. He's doing an American accent, but it's still that Patrick Stewart voice, and I just don't buy him as being this evil, cold-blooded guy. And both times I've seen it now, I just can't get past that. And it's almost I don't know. There are times sometimes where the casting just doesn't work, and I think this is one of those times for me. It doesn't hurt the film a lot. But I think it would have been better with someone other than Patrick Stewart.
I've heard people talk about how they wanted more intensity out of that role from him.
Yeah.
Like almost in the sense like, you know, a higher octave or like some screaming scenes or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
More energy. I really liked his presence with it. And I didn't have a problem with seeing him there. He fit well for me. I didn't find him as
menacing as he's supposed to be.
Okay.
And I'm not sure why, except I think it's those previous associations, and that voice is just too familiar.
All right.
Huh. Like, I don't know.
All right. So you hated the movie. Cool.
I give it an A-.
I give it a 10.
There we go. Now, Jeremy Saulnier and Anton Yelchin were just hanging around Portland, I think on a road trip, passing through. And we went and interviewed them. Because we didn't mention this. The movie was filmed not in Portland, but like near Portland, about 45 miles outside of Portland.
At one point, there is a scene at Seaside that I noticed as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
On the coast. But yeah.
So anyway, so we met with them and interviewed them, and here is that interview right now. Thank you for joining us here. First question, Jeremy, please say your last name for us.
Saunier.
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 All right. Thank you.
Lucky yay!
We like to get that right. That's the only question I had for you.
Okay, cool.
There we go.
It's been a pleasure. The movie comes out April 22nd in Portland.
All right, so the movie, I would say it definitely involves the underground punk scene, and it also involves neo-Nazis. For you, in choosing to write this movie, were those two things you were very familiar with beforehand?
Relatively. One more.
How familiar you are with the Nazis.
One more than the other. No. Back in the 1990s, you wouldn't know it by looking at me, but I was very much involved with the hardcore punk scene in Washington, D.C. Primarily, actually, in Alexandria, Virginia. It's a more insulated area, a very small scene. There was no Nazi punks within that scene, at least that I knew of. But we'd hop across the bridge into Washington, D.C., and all the big shows, yes, there were Nazi skinheads at almost every single one. I was never really part of any dangerous scenarios, but there was once a non-fatal stabbing outside of a club, and there was an element of danger. I was 15, 16 years old, so I was pretty young, and watching grown men do tough guy stuff. But I loved the music, and had a physicality to it that I liked being part of. I was a skate punk in the 80s, so it's just kind of a natural progression in my musical upbringing that did tie into my cinematic upbringing, in that the same kids I was going to punk shows with and playing in bands with were the same crew I was making movies with.
I did want to ask about that, about how you became a filmmaker, or what films or filmmakers inspired you.
Yeah, it was a very typical story. Like, I was introduced to early VHS technology back in the mid-80s.
Sure.
My mom was doing research at Gallaudet University for educational purposes. But she had access to, like, you know, these two big suitcases full of gear. This is back when, you know, the shoulder-mounted camera was tethered to a huge VHS deck that was strapped around your other shoulder.
Right.
But I would take it around, and I would make my movies, very kind of Mr. Bill kind of comedies, fine-scale models and just miniatures and setting shit on fire in my backyard, that sort of thing.
Nice.
And as I found my tribe, my filmmaking friends, we formed a little collective, and we started making, like, Michael Mann, Miami Vice type action drug lord movies. And
was Macon Blair in this early group, right?
Yeah, MegaCop. MegaCop was our first movie together. And a lot of the neighborhood kids came together with tempera paint in Ziploc bags and smacking them on our chests for blood squibs and all that. But it was like, Verhoeven, RoboCop, and Miami Vice. And
so this would have been like late 80s?
It's about 80. That's about 87, 88.
Okay.
Yeah. And then,
So, Anton,
Anton Yelchin, sorry, the star of the film, is also here with us.
That's right.
We forgot to mention that.
Did your agent send you the script? Is that how you first discovered Jeremy, or how did you...
Yeah, how did you get your hands on this bad boy?
I copped it off your computer. it just came through agent.
And I'm assuming you, at that point... My guess would be you hadn't seen Murder Party.
I hadn't seen Murder Party.
Blue Ruin.
I watched Blue Ruin when I heard about the film.
Okay.
Yeah, and I really liked it a lot, and that made me, even before I read the script, want to work with Jeremy. And then it was a punk rock script, a script about a punk band, and that moved me very much.
Do you have a punk background as well?
My friends and I had like a crusty garage punk band when I was like 18, and they'd all played in punk bands, and I listened to punk music and loved it, but never had a band until I was like in my late teens, and then we played together for a few years, and I had so much fun, and I just could, just, you know, for me, the most fun thing about being in a band is playing with your best friends, you know, and playing shows together and playing music together. We haven't played a show together in years, but like when we play music together, it's so much fun, you know, and there's something really, this bond that you form just playing with your buddies all the time. You just share so much in that space, you know.
What was the initial germ of the idea for Green Room? I mean, you said you had some background with
it. It was actually the Germs.
It was actual Germs.
No. The Germs.
Let's get dirty.
No.
Don Bowles.
You know, I can never really trace the actual origin of the idea, but I do know the premise was with me for almost a decade. Like, the punk band in the green room. It was more like, I'm very visual and tactile, and I like to explore environments. And being in the punk scene and going to shows, I was like, wow, what an amazing location to set a genre film, a siege movie. You could do it in a green room. You have a punk rock aesthetic. You got a band there. I can relate to that. Mm-hmm. And you can have it take place during a live concert and have it go haywire. And that was the dynamic that excited me the most.
So it was the siege aspect was kind of the core of it.
Trapped in the green room, right? Basically, okay. That was like, I never really got much further than that. I was like, trapped in the green room, awesome punk rock murder movie. I have no idea what it's going to do.
So I love how much the violence matters in this movie. Guns are present, but you actively find reasons not to involve them.
Yes.
Cinematically speaking. Do guns kind of get in the way sometimes with cool violence? Would you rather choose other weapons? Like, how do you view that whole thing?
Well, it was a fun challenge because it was not on me. It was on the characters. Because there's a certain reason, later revealed, and I won't spoil, they can't use guns. And so what could be a, 23-minute movie had to be a full, insane, chaotic extension of this very intricately...
Guns do tend to shorten design. The conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, they could have been employed, but then they wouldn't have been able to cover this up. The whole thing was to end up with, with erasing the night's events and not to add to the carnage. And to do that, they actually had to, double down on the sort of brutality and the way that these kids were dispatched.
Yeah.
So it was all, as you experience the film, it seems like the typical sadistic bloodlust and this savage brutality. But what you realize later is that, this is a very pragmatic, brass tacks, mop-up operation, and that makes it all the more disturbing. So, but the kids trapped in the room have no idea, and so you're with them, and you feel that tension, and the information deprivation is far more powerful,
You make violence matter in the film, and you've done that with your movies, and it's amazing. It's appreciated.
Yeah. I got to keep it grounded, and I just really try very hard to remove any false notes.
We've seen Green Room twice now. We saw it at Fantastic Fest the first time.
Oh, melted cool. Our faces.
Good.
And our faces had barely grown back when we saw it again a couple of weeks ago.
That's right.
We won't spoil it for those who haven't seen it yet, but your character suffers an amazing injury
in
this film. Just a great injury. I'm trying to remember, is that among the worst injuries you've suffered on film?
Well, I got killed in one film.
Well, you've been
so
killed,
so outside of being shot and buried.
As far as having to wear like prosthetic blood and carnage and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'll say it's the gnarliest.
Yeah, the gnarliest.
That was the gnarliest.
Yes.
That was a gnarly.
That's for me when the movie takes the level I wasn't ready to handle that level. I was ready to handle the other level that was previous involving a knife. But that level, it just made me go, oh my gosh, I don't know what I'm going to see now. I have no path.
Yeah.
And I loved that. Patrick Stewart's in this film. Did you or he care about your Star Trek connection at all? Did you have a moment between the two of you where you even mentioned that?
No, I don't think we did. I mean, I think that maybe there was one thing where it came up after the fact, you know? I'm trying to think, maybe at Toronto someone had said it and he sort of smirked or something, and I was like,
I mean, like, it's one of those things that, fans, of course,
obsess
about that sort of thing, but, the individual,
and that's not
I wonder
to slight
if it even
that for people
more.
That are, for fans that,
no,
that are fascinated by that, not to slight that in any way. I just think on set, we didn't really talk much when we were shooting together because it wasn't about that, you know? We spoke a lot, in the van afterwards about all sorts of things, but on set, we didn't, I don't remember... speaking to Patrick really once, actually. I don't remember having a single conversation with him on set. It just didn't seem conducive to what we were doing.
So Sir Patrick was really cold and aloof and rude.
And like, the sweetest man, by the way, after work.
Seems like it.
Yeah, and maybe I'm the cold and aloof man.
It's
I'm going to take
asshole
credit.
The way the film is staged, and what was exciting, I didn't even realize, but they don't really see each other.
They don't really share a screen door.
There is, we added one moment where Anton or Pat sees Patrick Stewart's character Darcy through a closing door briefly. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, we realized, like, wait, they wouldn't recognize each other because they'd never seen each other. So we had to have that one moment of connection that was so powerful. But that was added after we realized and did the math, like, wait, these people wouldn't actually know how to interact.
Good point.
Did you, okay, forget Anton's acting talent and the fact that he's also, I think, probably the biggest name or most popular actor you've worked with at this point.
Jan Brady was in Blue Ruin.
Sorry. did his voice... The way that he, you have like a crackly, amazing voice, especially for nervous situations, like it fits perfectly. Did
not
that,
for any other kind of situation.
No.
Wildly,
man, did it work terribly. No, but like, did that matter for you when you were looking for the lead of this film?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, his voice was certainly factored in.
Yeah.
Because what I needed is someone that's.
You're really good at sounding terrified.
Well, it's also just it's also relatable. Like,
yes.
And what I needed was youth, and his voice sounds young. And the big thing is, with Green Room, we were putting a whole lot of pressure. We put the entire weight of the film on the actors. And if you're doing a primarily 25 and under crowd, that's a very tall order. And Anton had both the chops and experience to helm this movie, and the youth I needed to make it. To drive home the dynamic of that these were kids, you know. And there's not many people that are 25 and under that can really do that. And once you're, it's not just the fact that I needed great performances, it's that we were trapping ourselves, the actors, the crew, me, the audience, in one room for about an hour, and there's no room for error. You cannot have bad performances. You cannot have false notes because we're all very exposed and it's basically real time, and we needed an amazing ensemble, and I think we found one.
Yeah, for sure. I wanted to ask about the dogs. First of all, are dogs, is that a thing that the neo-Nazis use? Was that a natural part of that story?
They're often involved in dog fighting, so culturally, yes.
Okay.
But I'm not sure as far as when they mount siege attacks.
What made you decide, let's have some attack dogs in this movie?
That's an idea I had for a while.
Okay.
But then, you know, as I did research, I've seen a lot of... I mean, the thing about the Nazi skinheads is they're not the bad guys in this film because they're Nazis. That's way too easy. But they do have a actual structure to their organization. They wear uniforms. Mm-hmm. They are associated with sort of a militant attitude and firearms and dogfighting. So like, they really are the best candidates. I mean, I can't have – there's Krishna Corps, and I can't have Hare Krishnas. Bad guys. It wouldn't make a lot of sense.
Right. There's a really good efficiency with everybody, even the band. Like when a problem arrives – I feel like there's a good group discussion about what should be next, to the point where normally you feel like when you're watching a movie like this, you could process, I wouldn't do that. I would go this way. But they kept everybody involved, I felt, both sides kept being like, wow, that's the best thing for this moment. Mm-hmm. Good luck.
And I have more dog questions. did you get to play with the dogs? Were they nice dogs in real life?
Get to play with them because they are professionals and they are very focused. They are very nice.
Okay. They're not really attack dogs, but they're professionals.
No, they're trained, and most of that is very hardcore playing.
Yeah.
But it's also very dangerous.
Right.
I mean, so doing my research, you know, pit bulls are demonstrably a friendly breed, more friendly than most. Than poodles. The problem is they're trained for, physically they're bred to be very powerful, and they're trained for gameness. And that is the inability to let go, the gameness to never stop clinching and fighting and jawing until the adversary is dead. So if something goes wrong with a pit bull, they're trained, they're bred, to keep going. Now, these dogs were beautiful and friendly and were trained in advance to do specific stunts. And we had a very expensive, very detailed dog puppet fabricated as an insurance policy. Because I was scared. I've heard like how tough it can be, you know, kids, water, fire, dog, animals, whatever. And we used that dog puppet for a single shot the entire film because they executed their work flawlessly. Nice.
Well, and it, and the dogs also thematically, and you can tell me if I'm just making this up, but what you were saying about how they pit bulls are trained that way or bred that way, it seems like dogs, like people, are not born hating, or they're not born vicious, but they have to be taught that. And then once the motivation to be vicious goes away, then they're not anymore.
That is the, pretty much the thesis of the movie.
I got it.
Yeah.
Nice.
So did you, with filming in Oregon, around Portland, that sort of thing, did either of you have a favorite Portland discovery?
I'm worried it's going to be some goofy tourist trap.
That's all right.
Yeah,
there's a pretty good breakfast joint on Mississippi Avenue. Is it called Gravy?
Gravy's
yes.
place, yeah. Gravy's
yeah, place. I know it's typical,
okay.
but
it's okay.
I was basically just holed up in my sort of dormitory, and I'd go to Gravy and indulge and pass out and go back to work. But I think for me, it was actually taking a moment when we were shooting. Is it Rhododendron? Is that an area?
Mm-hmm.
That's where the exterior venue is. It's outside of Portland.
It's past Boring, Oregon.
Oh, over there.
I swear,
I know.
I just
Boring's
like
place.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Boring's place.
It's past Boring. Okay. Like we were.
All right, right.
It's sort of the secluded venue where we shot. Just once in a while, just taking a moment and just seeing how gorgeous and lush the environment was on the mountainside. Yeah, I think that was my favorite part. But
cool.
I do want to shout out Mississippi Records though, because I found a Mississippi record in Germany. And bought it and was like, if I ever go to Portland, I gotta go. And then, like, 3 years later, I was in Portland and I was like, I gotta go to Mississippi Records. I love that place.
Yeah, awesome.
I wanna go back today.
Awesome. I wanted to ask you made Murder Party was 2007, and then Blue Room was 2014. What happened between there? Were you trying to get stuff made?
Yeah, basically, you know, I self funded primarily both those movies. Mm-hmm. Murder Party was 2007, and. We did not make a lot of money on that movie, so I had to go back to my corporate video day job. Mm. Took a while, but in 2009, I realized I was getting way too soft. I'd lost touch with narrative filmmaking, had a light, and had to block those scenes. I was just doing talking head interviews. So I went back into the independent film scene, worked for free on movies, digital video, and just learned cinematography, shooting for my friends. And from 2007 to 2012, I started to engineer a plan of how to make a new calling card, which would be something I could really stand by that would utilize modern technology. Cameras were getting cheaper and smaller and looking better and better and better. So then when Blue Ruin was a sort of a long game situation where the discipline was not making a movie, it was waiting until I could afford to do it the right way, gave myself 30 days to shoot it, engineered it with my best friend as the lead, and all the available resources and locations I had at my disposal. And then I went for it in 2012, and then I've been kind of never looking back.
Right. Well, and then Green Book came along fairly soon after that.
Yeah, I fast tracked. I felt that, you know, the terror is that you'll be discovered as a fraud and lose momentum and never get to make a movie again. So I fast tracked this movie. I shoved it down the throats of all involved. And I look forward to shoving it down the audience's throats in about a week and a half.
The Jeremy Saulnier train is rolling. Saulnier? Did I remember?
Saulnier.
Jeremy Saulnier train is rolling.
There we go.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Next up, The Huntsman, Winter's War.
Oh, more from The Huntsman series.
You remember this great new franchise established a few years ago, Snow White and The Huntsman.
But you know who was getting in the way?
Mm.
Snow White.
Yeah, really no need for her in that Snow White movie.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Well, the back of her head was needed for this movie.
What a weird, stupid mess this is.
Why does this exist? Why does it exist?
That's what we've been wondering ever since this was announced. Because that first one, Snow White and the Huntsman, 2012 it was. It's been 4 years, really. That was one with Kristen Stewart and Charlize Theron was the Wicked Witch. You remember there were two Snow White movies that year. There was also Mirror, Mirror. This
with
was the...
Julia Roberts and?
I'm going to say Kate Blanchett.
Who knows?
Who knows? This was the more serious of the two, the less fun, less kid-friendly one, Snow White and the Huntsman. And now, for some reason, a sequel. I mean, it did fine, but like nobody said we want to see more. Nobody, not one person.
Maybe we don't quite understand, and it's like back to 1950s at the studio, and Chris Hemsworth signed a multi-picture deal with Universal. He had to make it. Who knows? Charlize Theron had to make it. Who knows? But yeah, so here we are.
Here we are with this is mostly a sequel. It's a sequel, but it begins with 30-minute prequel. But it's mostly a sequel that begins with like 30 minutes of, but here's some stuff that happened before the first one. We told you this story, so we can tell you that story.
I think it's a prequel-sequel spinoff. I think it's fair to say it's that, which maybe it's the first of its kind. Bravo. If that's the case, because what we learn in this is huntsmen no longer singular, huntsmen, and they've been created by an evil witch from a Disney movie, which I don't exactly know how that's done.
They worked out the rights, but yeah, Queen Freya, played by Emily Blunt, she's a frozen girl. She can make ice and stuff. She becomes an ice queen, makes her own little ice kingdom up in the north.
It is so weird how it's just like a blatant, hey, remember that Frozen movie was popular? Right. Let's make a sequel of Huntsman and put that one in it.
And Freya is the sister of Ravenna, the Charlize Theron character, who was the evil queen in the first one.
You remember Ravenna talking constantly about her sister from the movie Frozen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, she was always talking about her Frozen sister.
In the lands up north, just like we've plucked them. Frozen? What else have we plucked from? Game of Thrones. We've plucked from, what else was blatant in this situation? There was something else where it's just like, are you kidding me? Like, you're doing that as well?
So while that first movie was going on, which was Snow White and the Huntsman teaming up and fighting against the Evil Queen, and so they killed Ravenna, Charlize Theron, at the end of that movie, and then peace reigned in the kingdom. But now, several years later, Ravenna's ice queen sister wants that. No, that's the mirror. That's right, it's the mirror. The magic mirror. Turns out the magic mirror, not just magic, it's evil. The mirror is evil, and it's given Snow White trouble, so she wants to get rid of it.
But then it's stolen by...
She sends her guys out to take it out to, I don't know, out to Goodwill to drop it off? I don't know.
No. What? They keep saying, adventure. Like... The sanctuary?
They're going to take it somewhere.
It's like, wherever they're going to take it, it's great. That place is fantastic for taking things.
But the Huntsman, but Chris Hemsworth, and a couple of his dwarf friends, they need to get the mirror and destroy it. And they need to stop Queen Freya from getting it.
Yes.
Because they know that Queen Freya wants it. That's Emily Blunt, by the way. She wants the mirror, and she's evil. She can't have it.
Queen Freya is evil because something very tragic happened a while ago to her daughter.
Mm-hmm. Her baby and her baby daddy.
Yes. And so then she declares, love is evil. Love is a sin.
Love is a lie. Do not love. That's the one rule she has.
It's the one rule. And so what she decides is, I know what I'll do. Since I'm really sad, I'm going to go north, freeze everything, and steal a bunch of kids to make an army to do something.
Mm-hmm. To be an army of huntsmen and huntswomen, huntspersons.
Really well, the well-trained army just, I guess, okay. Why are you doing that again? Because you lost your daughter?
And Chris Hemsworth, the huntsman, his name's Eric in the movie, he came through this training program with Sarah, played by Jessica Chastain. And they fall in love, which was forbidden, so that's trouble. And so now... Eric the Huntsman and a couple of dwarves are trying to get the mirror before the Queen Freya can get it. Some people in the movie are Scottish sometimes. The dwarves, they find a couple of lady dwarves. The dwarves point out, first of all, that female dwarves are hideous, just ugly. I didn't feel like the movie fully appreciated or fully acknowledged in that moment how ugly these two male dwarves also are. I'm not sure that it was as aware of that as it needed to be.
It was either a joke that missed. The joke missed, but it was either a joke about how dwarves don't find each other attractive,
right?
Period, or That, yeah, like, they're not nearly as ugly as you made them out to be.
Right, or the men have, and it's actually a very common thing, that very ugly men will remark on the ugliness of women.
Right.
Without, you know, noticing how hideous they themselves are. That's all annoying. All the dwarves are annoying. Sarah, is that her? Yeah, Jessica Chastain. She shows up. She's angry. She's never going to get over it. And then she immediately just gets over it.
And as soon as she shows up and the bickering happens between Sarah and Eric, it's just like, seriously, you're gonna bicker for whatever time length it is, and then you're going to be okay because he'll rescue or you'll rescue or whatever the reason is. This is – it felt like an utterly forced-in waste of time mm-hmm. because we – all of these beats feel so, so familiar because they're borrowed from, you know, all other movies.
Everything else.
Yes. And so by that rationale, it's just like even like there's a moment where Eric is climbing a cliff. And it's just like, well, we just need to wait to get for him to be done climbing this cliff.
Right.
But yet the movie is like, oh, no, he lost his footing. Is he going to fall? And it's like, no, he's not going to fall.
Yeah.
This isn't exciting and you're not offering anything. And even the moment then that the movie thinks is really cool after he climbs a cliff where he's jumping and sliding around and trying to get his axe going, it was a great opportunity for like an over the top humor thing or something to really make us laugh. But the only thing that they attempt to do to break any seriousness that the movie thinks that it has is have the dwarves do something.
Those stupid dwarves.
And it's just like, they are. They're stupid.
The whole thing is...
Snow White and the Huntsman. I didn't really remember much of it, but like, okay, I guess those little fairies existed in that world too, maybe?
Yeah, they're little fairy creatures, woodland creatures and things, yeah. Magical forest.
Here's something I don't remember at all. Did Liam Neeson narrate the first one?
Is that who this was?
I think that was Liam Neeson.
Because
he's narrating this excessively in the beginning to the point where you're like, dude, it's overkill. You're just telling me that she's walking over there and I see her walking over there. Stop it.
I don't remember anything about the first one. This all is so poorly thought out and passionless and just relentlessly mediocre. And it feels like Chris Hemsworth is working alone all the time, even when he's not.
Agreed.
And it's bad and stupid.
It needs to stop. And what's really weird here is at the core of it, like if you were to just tell some plot points here, you'd be like, oh, well, that probably would be a good adventure movie. And it just fails on screen completely. Like the two sisters, the lie, the need for power, like the misinterpretation of a lost love, all of that stuff seems like it would be good. And it's lifeless.
We should also mention the funny thing with Kristen Stewart. Snow White is in this movie, sort of. She is alive and well, and it is on her instructions that we're getting rid of the mirror. But we don't see her except once from the back because they didn't have Kristen Stewart. And right, I don't know if they didn't even bother asking her or if they asked and she said no. But so instead, there's Sam Claflin, who was in the first movie, shows up for one scene, rides up on a horse to tell Chris Hemsworth, hey, Snow White wants you to go out and destroy this mirror or whatever. So he fulfills Kristen Stewart's obligation to be Snow White. And then he's gone too. Just the one scene.
I didn't even know he was in the first one. Mm-hmm. I was just like, maybe he is, maybe he's not. I don't know.
So that's amusing, the way that they work around Snow White's absence.
Now, the bigger deal here is something we talked about after the film.
Right.
I'm not sure, but I think it might be offensive now that dwarves are not being played by little people in films, that we're doing CGI with actors now.
Right, using real people to play little people.
Because
not real people, because little people are real too, but like tall people.
We don't do this with other people that exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's generally offensive. Not that it isn't done, but it always upsets people when someone is cast as a different race or whatever. Why is this okay?
Is this okay? I think I don't like it anymore. I'm done with it. I don't like it anymore.
I think you and I, as non-little people, as big people, I don't think it matters what we think. I'm not a big fan of getting offended by proxy.
No. I do agree with that, but then I thought this through even more. Hmm. Like, because then part of me was just like, oh, should I investigate if little people are offended? And it's like, right. Well, hang on. I don't want to get more offended if little people are offended, because I want it to be my, like, I've decided I'm offended. It's up to me to decide that, as opposed to just like, oh, I should ask a little person how they feel, right, and then determine my feelings based on if they're offended or not. I think it's wrong. I think we should be employing little people, like Little People's Corner for acting is the action adventure world. Like that is the go-to. That is where they're going to get their most.
And to play elves in Christmas things.
There we go.
Yeah.
So, I don't like this trend. And not only that, it has to cost money, like much more money.
Oh, sure.
To do the effects and get this right and all of that stuff. And even then, the little people are there as stand-ins on occasion, like with horses and everything. And then it's even worse.
Predictably, I don't care. It doesn't bother. It might bother me if I discover that little people actually are bothered by this, then on their behalf, maybe I would sympathize with them. But without any of that context, I don't care. And I've been trying to figure out why I think that it's different from like performing in blackface. And
yes.
I can't put my finger on why a racial impersonation is more offensive or more wrong than a size impersonation. And I'm not sure. I think it's because it comes down to when we do this, we're not looking at dwarfism as being a group, but more of a physical attribute. And so it's the same as like putting on a wig or wearing a fat suit or whatever. I think that's how Hollywood looks at it. And maybe, yeah, I don't know if that's maybe they shouldn't look at it that way, but I think that's kind of the thinking. It's just a physical, almost a costume kind of a thing.
And. For the most part, if you are doing blackface, then you're doing a social critique on African Americans.
You're also parodying and ridiculing.
Whereas maybe we don't feel like little people have a society that is their own, but well, they most definitely do.
Well, and I think it's not that, when tall actors play little people, they're not ridiculing little people. They're not usually hopping around dancing like, look at me, I'm a little person, which is usually what blackface turns into, an exaggerated mocking thing. So I don't know. Here's what I determined. First of all, one possibility, maybe they didn't hire actual little people because there's a shortage of them. Then I thought, no, a shortage is actually what you call a group of little people. They're called a shortage. Yeah, there's a whole shortage of dwarves came by. And that's when I stopped.
I'm still outraged.
Okay.
All right.
Did we give grades? I forgot if
no,
we gave it grades.
Oh. We didn't. What'd you give it?
D.
Yeah, it's a 3 out of 10.
All right. That was certainly more discussion than the Huntsman Winter's War merited.
Yes, I agree. I'm surprised. Sure. Yes.
Now let's talk about Elvis and Nixon. The movie, not the guys.
Okay.
Elvis and Nixon. It's about that famous photo, everyone's seen it, of Nixon and Elvis shaking hands in the Oval Office.
Mm-hmm.
And it's famous.
What?
It's so incongruous. Here's the crazy rock and roll guy with like the meanest, grumpiest establishment guy.
Mm-hmm. It's December 1970, mm-hmm. And we know this is true, that the photo was taken. Nixon hasn't started recording everything that he's done, so we don't know what their conversation was.
Don't have that.
And the movie doesn't say, like, this is all true, but it definitely gives you the vibe of, like, yeah, this totally could have been what it was like.
Yeah, there are many questions about the incident that are not, that we don't know the answers, but we do know some of them, and the movie has those. And the answers that we don't have, the movie just makes them up, which is fine, because this is what I like about this movie. It is a trivial event. It did not matter that Nixon and Elvis met. It didn't lead to anything. It didn't have any deeper import. It could have, but it didn't. And so it's fine to have a movie that is just as trivial and silly and jaunty, and we'll stick to the facts as far as they're known for the most part, and then we'll throw some other stuff in, and that's fine.
Yeah, it is utterly charming and playful, and that's how they keep it, and that's why it's okay that they're potentially not, you know, by the book, everything happened
right
here that we know.
This tone wouldn't work for, like, a Watergate movie.
Right.
Or something more serious, but something like, dumb like this, sure, it's funny.
So we have Kevin Spacey as Richard Nixon.
All hunchbacked and Nixon-y.
And then, for me, much more important, we have Michael Shannon as Elvis. And, oh, goodness.
Did you even know that you needed Michael Shannon's Elvis impersonation in your life?
No, I had no idea. And now it's the only Elvis impersonation I want more of in the future that I know of.
And I don't think it's even a particularly accurate impersonation.
It's not.
Character as he plays it is just so I love this character, Elvis, as this lovable, irresponsible kook who has to be supervised at all times by responsible adults.
Yeah, and I'd say maybe even upwards of the first half of the movie is really mainly his journey. And then the second half of the movie is Nixon hanging out with him.
Right.
So Shannon is definitely the lead here. And it's interesting because, like, I was thinking about everything. Like, opening credits, the song Hold On, I'm Coming, that classic rock song is on. And, like, I'm like, wait a minute. You're not using an Elvis song? And then as the movie goes along, they're not using Elvis songs at all. And so, like, that's
using
a conscious
70s songs.
Right. That's a conscious choice. And what's really cool about it is then you're seeing Michael Shannon's Elvis occasionally reacting to these songs and appreciating these songs or not or whatever. And, like, that's another cool little element here that's just icing on this really, tasty cake.
What happens, Elvis decides he wants to, he is worried about the country with the wars and the riots and the drugs and everything. Mm-hmm. And he's a patriotic American, wants to help out however he can. He writes a handwritten letter to Nixon offering his services. He wants to be an undercover narcotics officer.
Federal agent at large.
He wants a badge and everything. And he shows up to deliver this letter. He with his friend, played by Alex Pettyfer, Jerry Schilling. Alex Pettyfer show up at the White House with the letter, and then it's the Nixon's guys, Colin Hanks and Evan Peters, get the letter, and they're like, hey, this would be a good opportunity, because everyone hates our boss, but everyone loves Elvis, so maybe let's have them meet, and that'll help. And Nixon, as always, skeptical and paranoid, vulgar, profane,
And disinterested for quite a while.
Disinterested, yeah. Just doesn't have any interest in this. And this is almost certainly not true, but it's one of the details that makes me like the movie, is that he, thanks to some meddling from his assistants, he gets a phone call from his daughter, Julie, who implores him to do the meeting.
So you know what's really funny? I just caught Kevin Spacey, I think, on Colbert.
Oh, yeah?
And he said that particular part was true.
Really?
Yes, he did. Yes, he said it was true. Yes.
That's
and I was
funny.
Quite surprised by that.
That surprised me. But the reason I like it is that even if it's not true, it's such an appealing sitcom-y moment to have the Nixon being begged to get a rock star's autograph for his baby girl that I have no problem taking it as entertainment, if not
and
as
it makes
truth.
Perfect sense for 1970. I mean, it's Bieber and Britney Spears and everybody and Taylor Swift and whoever you want to say and Kanye West, all of that combined is Elvis Presley in 1970. Alex Pettyfer is the kind of through character through this story. He's the normal because everybody is, again, either Elvis or Nixon or like desperately trying to please Elvis or Nixon. And it's a really necessary character for this to give it just enough reality to
groundedness.
Groundedness to where you would kind of wonder what you would be like in this situation.
He's basically babysitting Elvis, but he's got to get back home to L.A. He's got a life and stuff. And he has a nice scene with the Colin Hanks character as Nixon's whatever he is guy, where they're both kind of relating to having to deal with these bosses. And it's also, I enjoy the actual meeting of Nixon and Elvis where we see the things that if you think about it, they do have a lot of things in common. Both very famous men who are, you know, their fame affects what they're able to do and what they're allowed to do.
Right.
And they've got that they can relate to. And I love Nixon's pettiness. Like, there's some about which is bigger, the White House or the Graceland, and Nixon sort of jealous of Elvis's youth and good looks. And
I absolutely loved how both of them, both of their people were coached on how to, like, how Presley should talk to Nixon and how Nixon should talk to Presley. And then there's a lot of, I guess you can say, like, dick wagging from Presley here. In that regard specifically, whether about like where it is they're sitting or a lot of like fun little things I won't get into here.
And Nixon is the president, so there's a lot of formality built into that, a lot of protocol. And Elvis just kind of does whatever he wants. And throughout the movie, I really enjoy that about him, how he'll just show up places and people like see him. Because Elvis Presley, 1970, people are starstruck and amazed. And he's just kind of showing up, doing his thing. And I, like, he'll show up at the airport with a bunch of guns on him, thinking that he can get on the plane because, after all, the sheriff of some podunk town made him an honorary deputy once or something. And you think, does Elvis really think that gives him rights? And I don't know in real life. In the movie, yes, he seems to. He seems to really think that. I don't know if he was this crazy in real life, but it doesn't matter, again, because there are other places to go for insightful biographies of either of these guys.
Yeah. And that's there probably won't be a lot of people that seek this out thinking, oh, I bet this will be a really fun time. Like when they hear Elvis and Nixon, maybe they will.
They should.
But they should. Yep. That's the thing. It is a really good time, and I liked it quite a bit.
And it's only a fun time. That's the thing. There isn't really no larger insight or depth into it. It's really just a fun, silly story about a fun, silly thing that happened.
Well, what do you give it?
I give it a B+.
Nice. I give it an 8 out of 10.
BS approved. Two-in-one
yes,
show.
Approved.
Nice.
The most important thing about this movie, in Eric's opinion, if you judge things that you will say out loud in a movie theater to somebody sitting next to you, is that Eric doesn't feel like the Memphis airport is accurately portrayed in this film.
Here's the thing. Here's why it jumped out at me.
The best part about this is he said it. And I have to ask you this now, because we haven't talked about this since you turned to me and told me this during the movie. Are you thinking the movie did it wrong? Or are you thinking, oh, I guess there's a really good chance that since 1970, the Memphis airport has had a facelift?
No, because the facelift would mean that the Memphis airport has become one-tenth the size that it used to be.
Oh.
That's the thing. I was thinking about this. Here's why it jumped out. There aren't many airports that I'm intimately familiar with. Lots that I've been to or been through or whatever, but as far as like spending a lot of time at, there aren't very many. Memphis happens to be one because that's where I go when I go to Oxford, Mississippi. And so I've spent many hours waiting in the Memphis airport for my shuttle and then also going home again waiting for delayed flights. And so I'm very familiar. It's a mom and pop airport. It's a small little dumpy airport. And there is no way it was that huge and ornate in 1970. I don't think of it as like a big flaw in the movie. Just to me, it jumped out as like, oh, they obviously didn't bother trying to get it right. They just filmed an airport. And here's what actually is important to me about this movie.
Go ahead.
It's rated R because they say the F word 5 times.
Oh, jeez.
There's no sex, nudity, violence, or anything, but they say the F word 5 times. There might be a couple more where someone was sort of muttering under his breath, but you hardly count them. But anyway, it's rated R just for that. Further proof that the rating system is useless. There's no reason not to see this movie.
Yeah, your 8-year-old would love it. Take your 8-year-old to this movie. Eric's right.
The teenagers, anyway. It's totally a PG-13 movie.
Yeah, if your teenager knows who Presley or Nixon is, good job.
Yeah, and they want to see a comedy about them. There's no harm in that.
Right, right.
Anyway.
That is the first time you've spoken to me during a movie in, I don't know, fill in the blank.
I leaned over and whispered.
I think it was hilarious. It couldn't be contained.
I had to get that out.
Had to.
And then you saw something I didn't see.
That's right. I saw a movie called Miles Ahead.
Tell me about it. Tell me everything.
Ooh, everything?
Mm-hmm. First of all, who's it about?
Miles Davis, my friend.
Okay, don't say anymore. I don't want to be spoiled. No, you could. Go ahead.
Don Cheadle. This is a passion project of his. He's been trying to do this for years. He is starring, he is directing, and he also helped write the film. And it is an exploration, a fictitious exploration, in a gap of time where Miles Davis was not recording anything. And so this
like
is just...
Like the Nixon and Elvis thing?
Oh, no.
Happened during the time when he wasn't recording?
No. Like, not recording anything as in, like, he wasn't making any new music.
Oh, recording. Period. Okay, got it.
Like, he was done.
Inactivity, he was professionally.
Right. Complete gotcha. Inactivity. It is a vibe film. Not to the extreme of, like, Terrence Malick, where it's just images and that's it. But it's a vibe because, like, you know, we don't know if this is really what he was like. But mm-hmm. this is a focus on... his nutty side where he was dipping into drugs and occasionally having a gun in his hand. And it's all about this kind of like stolen record session that he desperately wants back. Ewan McGregor is trying to get an interview from him and becomes kind of his sidekick during this whole thing. Mm. It's cool. It's cool. Like, I will say that. Anytime I can learn again about a jazz musician while not like reading a book
or I'm without having to listen to jazz.
And not only that, it's like going into it, I knew that it was a vibe movie as opposed to here's what happened during the time that he wasn't recording. Right.
It's not like Dewey Cox, The Walk Hard Story.
No,
he doesn't have to stop and think about his whole life before he does a show.
No. But Don Cheadle does a really good job as Miles Davis. And it's, if you're interested in that kind of thing, because it's that weird thing where you're like, well, you're not going to learn tons of stuff about the life and times of Miles Davis. That'll be for another film, another day. And it's not like it's not nearly as fun and happy as Elvis and Nixon, but it's somewhere around there. I give it a 7 out of 10.
7 out of 10. Miles again, ahead.
Yeah, good job by Don Cheadle.
For our listeners overseas in Europe, Miles Ahead is being released under the title Kilometers Ahead. So watch for that. Come on. You know you want to smile. There it is.
Oh, what if somebody thought they were like you were talking directly to them? Like they were groaning while listening and then you made them smile. Maybe that happened.
You, Dallas. Dallas Butternubs, I saw you frowning. You know you want to smile.
It's the only confirmed listener we have.
Right. Speaking of our listeners, it's time for Question of the Week.
Question of the Week.
We asked you guys, what is the most shameful or most elaborate, most outrageous, etc., food or beverage you smuggled into a movie theater? I'm going to be honest with you here. I didn't think we were going to get very many good answers to this.
This is what the people want to talk about, apparently.
And I was mistaken. I'm delightfully mistaken because we got some fine answers here. I think just because I don't tend to smuggle in anything particularly unusual, it didn't occur to me that this is a thing that people really do in seriousness.
Well, but it's weird because
some people
do. Well, now for press screenings, there's definitely been moments where I've smuggled in a sandwich.
That's
or
true.
A
yeah, for impressive. You gotta bring whatever you want. Generally,
and it doesn't. That's right. It doesn't feel like smuggling because nobody's really telling you not to do it anymore. Because it's kind of that thing of like, well, I'm here for work.
Right.
In my earlier days, I never felt shame. I'll say that.
No.
I would bring in anything I wanted, and I would hide it or not hide it or be confident. I used to be the guy who would just like have a bag of McDonald's, and I'd be like, watch. I'll just be confident, and they'll let me do this.
Oh, just walk in carrying the bag?
Yes. And it did work for a while because it's like, why does a high schooler want to deal with that?
Right. I usually would anyway. Well, at least I'll hide it in my bag, my satchel, my man satchel.
My mom had an actual like bag that she purchased being like, oh, this is going to be perfect for bringing popcorn into the movie theater. Which I think is great because
she would bring her own popcorn,
microwave popcorn. She would bring it into the theater for like when her and my dad would go to a movie.
It would be cold, but you pop it at home and then go to the theater.
That's what you do. That's what she did. That's what she
but
did.
If you're going to sneak something in, why not sneak in something better than popcorn?
Maybe they just really like, I don't know, but that's what they did. And the best part is, like, she's a terribly honest person.
Right.
So on some level, she must have, in the beginning at least, felt a little guilt for that. Anyway.
My favorite answer, and this really gets to the heart of it. Nathaniel says the most outrageous was a large watermelon. And it was a running contest that his friends and he had in high school to see what they could sneak in.
I didn't read that one for some reason. I didn't get to it yet.
Honorable mentions include cereal, including a gallon of milk, ice cream, 6 packs of IBC root beer, apples and peanut butter, a jar of pickled chili peppers, and, at one time, on his person, 6 items from the Wendy's dollar menu, including a cup of chili.
Oh, you got to be careful with that.
I read an account from Kevin Murphy, who was the voice of Tom Servo on Mr. Science Theater. He wrote a book called A Year at the Movies, where he went to the movies every day for a year. And one of the things he did to amuse himself during that time was to see how much food he could bring in, and he smuggled an entire Thanksgiving dinner. Some of it on the principle you talked about, where if you just walk like you know what you're doing, people kind of don't bother you.
Right.
So yeah, large watermelon is a great thing too. Now, I'm curious whether like you cracked it open and ate it, or did you just have to like bring it in, just so you could say you brought it in.
That'd be amazing.
Spitting the seeds on the floor.
Oh man. Here's some that I. And sadly, we should have saved best for last because now nothing compares. No offense, Cameron. But he did have a soda can in his coat pocket. At a time, he did it, opened it up, and boom, exploded everywhere on his face and chest. And the best part is he could hear snickering from nearly everyone around him. That's the best part, because there's no better feeling than when it's like, yeah, that's what you get for doing that thing that I don't care about, but now I do.
That I maybe have done before, too. Yeah.
Right. Yes.
Yep. Trying to be all sneaky, wait for a loud part of the movie, and very quietly open the can. Yep. Cameron also mentions that he personally was once smuggled into a drive-in theater in the trunk of a friend's car, which, as he points out, is not a food item, so it doesn't qualify.
Yeah. If he was eaten, that would have been the number one answer.
That's true. And that I can't be on board with. With the sneaking into it, because you can't steal the movie. You shouldn't steal the movie. Bringing in food to eat during the movie, I have no problem with that ethically. Personally,
Kurt says, "My wife and I snuck," or he says "sneaked." He's asking you, Eric. You know, directly asking.
I know, and I'll give you the answer in a minute. Go ahead and read his thing.
A flask of rum into a midnight showing of Iron Man to mix with their cherry cola. Next morning, he read a review the same movie. Wherein the author, he thought it was James Rocky, our friend, but hasn't been able to confirm, described the movie as being fun popcorn entertainment with just a dash of salaciousness, like the splash of rum you add to a cherry cola.
Wow.
Anyway, very surreal moment that he points out. Before we started recording, I emailed James and asked
him. Oh, did you?
Yep. And here's his exact line. Mm-hmm. It's as if someone snuck a hefty slug of bourbon into your cherry cola.
Nice.
All the sugar and flavor and fizz you expect from a well-made comic book movie are there, but there's something a little more grown up going on behind them.
Nice.
James Rocky.
That is a fun coincidence that Kurt.
Yes.
Now, apparently not the actual same variety of liquor, but close.
It was close enough, Kurt. We allow it.
Yeah. I like that.
Although, I mean, if somebody tried to give me rum when I asked for bourbon, I'd, oh my God.
Sure.
What would I do, Eric? What would I do? Would I just give him a shameful look?
It would depend on did you buy this drink or is someone just offering you a drink for free?
Oh, that would be the perfect time where I'd be warranted in a spit take.
Yes. There's never really a wrong time for a spit take.
If you're alone.
Well, yeah, if there's no one there to appreciate it, maybe that would be a bad time. I'm not at all surprised that it was James Rocky who used that description. Sounds very much like him.
Yes.
As far as sneaked and snuck, sneaked is officially the correct past tense, and snuck is irregular. But it's been around since the 1850s, so it's now very common and mostly accepted. You'll get some hardliners who'll be like, "No, you need to say sneaked," but for the most part, snuck is generally considered okay. But technically not correct, because no other verbs do that. Like the past tense of leak isn't Luck. Or any of the others. It's totally
Everybody's tuned out. Eric, nobody's listening anymore. Stop. Stop.
Anyway, so the answer is Sneaked is technically better, but you're okay with Snuck.
Do you want to read one now?
I do. Rose, A. Rose McCoy, says witness a family member and their date consume a box of chicken wings during some action movie. Instead of putting the bones back in the box, they threw them on the floor. Shameful. Yeah, that's excessive.
I would not bear witness to a family member doing that.
Just leaving the bones on the floor is what I would have the issue with.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, but not only that. Chicken wings?
Well, that's quiet. At least it's not a loud, crunchy food.
There's a lot of, like, kind of sucking off the bone with chicken wings. You got to be careful with that. It depends on the person. Like, it can be done right.
If it's a loud action movie, you're probably okay.
Yeah, but if there's a lot of sauce in that, you're doing this. Like, occasionally, you're doing that noise, and that's not cool.
You shouldn't do that anyway. Even not in a movie theater.
You got to focus. You got to respect the chicken wing when you're eating it.
You've always said that.
Always. Emily, I don't understand. My friend's mom had a food storage business, and so we decided it would be fun to sneak in some canned goods into a showing of Titanic. Why does the food storage – it just means that they have a plethora of cans?
I would imagine that a food storage business probably is selling either the containers to store food in or maybe shelving, like to keep it organized for people who have like a good food storage in their basement or whatever.
Well,
it's a business. Yeah.
When the nude famous nude scene begins, they all ducked down, and instead of watching they watched one of their friends open the canned goods with the snuck-in can opener, and then now they associate Titanic with the taste of tiny fruit cocktail.
Of tinny fruit cocktail.
Tiny.
Yeah.
Tiny.
That's that's everything about that to me says Provo, Utah. The food storage business, the not wanting to watch the boob scene of Titanic, the whole making your own fun, all of that. Brings back fond memories of my time in Provo.
Fond memories. Oh boy. Okay. I did not see that twist coming at the end of that.
Oh, Provo. Mm-hmm. Warren says my brother would routinely sneak a can of Coke into the theater in his front pocket. His intention, were he ever questioned by the proprietor about the unsightly bulge in his jeans, was to simply say thanks. Oh, well, I misread that the first time. I thought you were saying that actually happened. You're saying his intention was that would be what he said if it ever came up. No, forget it. No, it doesn't count.
I was going to pass that one by. I was.
Yeah.
I was
no, I'm
do it.
Sorry. I misread that. Had that actually happened and he'd said thanks, that would be a good story. Daniel says, my wife smuggled in curry from the Whole Foods next door to movie theater in Maui. Open weekend of the Avengers in 2012. The smell was awful and much more damaging when the theater filled up and the staff informed us that the air conditioning was broken. Ugh. Hot, sweaty movie theater surrounded by curry. Whole Foods curry.
Amy had a friend who used her conveniently large purse to smuggle in 2 12-inch Subway sandwiches and an entire large Pizza Hut pizza.
Wow.
She didn't eat any of it herself, but distributed portions to people around her before even the lights dimmed. I'm not sure why. Weak thrill issues? Wow.
Yeah.
It is interesting.
Yeah, if that's how you get your thrills, it's a fairly harmless way of doing it, I suppose.
Well, the screening rats in Portland, one of them will like buy a large popcorn and distribute it to the others around them, not sitting anywhere near them.
Yep.
And that's a weird thing. I don't like that one. Though.
Some of them, I feel like that's the only meal they get, is that handful of popcorn they get when they go to the free movies. Alex says, some buddies and I hit a sandwich shop prior to seeing Freddy Got Fingered. Pal of mine wanted to bring his soft drink in with him, so he stuck into the pocket of his cargo shorts. The cashier at the ticket office said, sir, you're leaking. Apparently the styrofoam cup had tipped over and was spilling in real time across his lap, making it look as though he was pissing himself. The poor bastard sat through that abomination all cold and sticky. That's exactly the right way to watch Freddy Got Fingered. Cold and sticky. That's perfect.
Yes, it really is.
Yeah, they lost some burrito bowl from a Chipotle.
A giant waffle bowl of ice cream from Cold Stone Creamery.
Wow, that's a tough one.
I carried it with my right arm hand under my right armpit while draping my jacket over my right arm. I gave my ticket with my left hand. It was one of my finest moments.
Crystal and her husband smuggled tacos into Star Wars. A lot of very adventurous things that you people have gotten away with, and good for you.
Good job, everybody.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think that I've ever snuck anything in. The most elaborate would be like something from Wendy's or McDonald's, snuck in a bag, including the soda, and having to make sure it doesn't tip over in my in my bag.
Yeah.
But I think that's as...
I have tucked food into my back. Does that make sense?
Into, like... Put it under the back of your shirt?
Yeah, put it in the small of your back. Okay. Tuck in your shirt, put it in the small of your back, you're done. Yeah. In like, it's in a bag.
Sure, it's wrapped up. It's not just like a handful of loose M&Ms there in the small of your back.
Just some shredded lettuce in my pocket. No, nothing like that. Anyway, what's the question of the week for next week, Eric?
Well, for next week, we have a good suggestion from listener Brandon, and here's the question. You're going to hear a word in this question that may throw you off, but don't worry, we'll explain it. Here's the question. What is the best use of diegetic music in a movie?
Like what makes like
an important
everything
part of the scene?
Food, like food, digestive?
No,
like,
here's what diegetic means. Diegetic means that the music is in the world of the film. The characters hear it. For example, a song they're hearing on the radio. The example Brandon gives is the Reservoir Dogs ear-slicing scene where Stuck in the Middle of with You is on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So that is diegetic music as opposed to non-diegetic music, which is where it's just heard on the soundtrack, but the characters are not hearing it.
And the non-diegetic, like, that typically will give you, like, gas or, like, I get it.
Totally different, but yeah. So it's a thing you already knew what this was and maybe just didn't know what the word for it was, but it's diegetic. So tell us the best use of diegetic music as an important scene dynamic. And that example he gives of that song in Reservoir Dogs is kind of a perfect example. So tell us that. You can email us, moviebspdx@gmail.com, and it'll be on Facebook. You can post it there.
Mm-hmm. And you can go to moviebs.com whenever you want.
All your MovieBS needs are over there.
Yeah.
One other thing that we'd like input on, this is not the question of the week, but it's something we could use some input on if you have any. Jeff, do you realize what we're doing next week on the show?
No way.
We're doing our draft picks for the Summer Box Office Challenge.
Next week already?
Because the summer begins the week after that, yeah.
Oh my gosh, I have not begun to think about this.
Well, we have a week to do it.
Oh boy,
so
that's
next
not
week,
enough time.
We'll be doing the draft pick. I have, by the way, my penalty from losing the last one was watching Paul Blart Mall Cop 3 nights in a row and writing about it. I finally posted that. So it's on moviebs.com. It's finally posted.
Yay.
So that is complete. So now just in time for the next one. But you're going to lose this one. I'm confident. I feel it in my bones. But so what we would like, if you have any ideas for the stakes of the bet, for the terms of the bet, serious practical ideas. We don't need funny ones. We can come up with funny ones ourselves. We're very funny.
Right.
But if you have any practical, actual, feasible stakes of the bet, feel free to pass them on for our consideration. Because we've not narrowed that down yet. Got
right.
some ideas. But yeah. So you can pass those along if you have some. You excited for our sixth annual Summer Box Office Challenge?
This is our sixth annual.
Yeah.
So we've done it five times.
It's three to two so far.
I'm winning 3-2, mm-hmm. Is that right?
This is where I tie it up.
So this is the biggest one. This is the most important MovieBS Summer Box Office Challenge ever. Because if I can win, I got some breathing room.
This has the chance to put you further ahead of me than you've ever been. You've never been more than one ahead of me.
Right, and now if I win, I'll be twice as good as you if I understand how the world works. Like, I'll be twice as good. You'll be half me.
I don't think that's how that works.
Because divide two, yeah, yep,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, your math checks out.
You're half the man I am if I can pull this victory off.
Good thing you can't.
That makes sense.
I gotta start working on my trash talk. Gotta bone up on my trash talk. Hey, so that's the show. Green Room?
Great. Oh, that's so good.
Go see Green Room, unless our description of it makes it clear to you that you would not enjoy it, in which case don't, because you're right, you wouldn't.
My wife will never be seeing Green Room.
No. Your wife, though, I suspect would find Elvis and Nixon entertaining.
She probably would.
Most people would, I think. Elvis and Nixon, very funny, light, breezy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not political at all, by the way. Not, I don't know how many like hardcore Nixon defenders there are left in the world. But
yeah, I'd say Huntsman, Winter's War is a little more political.
Yeah, actually. Huntsman, Winter's War is bad. Don't see it.
Don't. It's a waste of time. Stop it.
And Miles Ahead, you said, is fine.
It's good.
If you're into that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that's it. Tell us your favorite use of diegetic music in a film for the question of the week. And we'll talk about that next week and do the draft. Oh, what a big show that'll be. I'm excited already about it.
I'm getting nervous.
Well, you still have a week to get over that.
That's true.
All right. So for Movie BS with Bear and Snyder, I'm Eric D. Snyder.
I'm Jeff Bear.
Thanks for listening and good day.
I said good day.